Out of Washington, D.C., that's Thievery Corporation with the title track from their 2002 album, The Richest Man in Babylon. This is Lead Stories. I'm Yatrice Lead. In the immediate aftermath of the August 9th killing of Michael Brown by ex-cop Darrell Wilson last year, Ferguson, Missouri became yet another symbol of legalized and enforced social, political, and economic apartheid in America. It was the basis for nationwide mobilization. It was an open admission in a slew of official inquiries and reports. Civil unrest and protest has died down now with the promise of administrative reforms. But the majority black city of 21,000 is still in the grip of economic apartheid and headed for Detroit-style imposed bankruptcy. Dr. Walter Johnson, Winthrop Professor of History and African and African American Studies at Harvard University, recently published an extraordinary article in The Atlantic on economic apartheid in Ferguson. And what was extraordinary about it was that, as you know, we've been discussing Ferguson here and the developments in Ferguson, and I had contended that Ferguson was being placed on the road to bankruptcy, perhaps as punishment for the uprising there in the aftermath of the killing of Michael Brown. Professor Johnson has written extensively on slavery, capitalism, and increasingly imperialism in the 19th century. He has written a book I recommend highly to you called Soul by Soul, about the slave market, and most recently published River of Dark Dreams, Slavery and Imperialism in the Mississippi Valley. He currently is writing a book about what is called the most successful slave revolt in U.S. history, on the 1841 revolt aboard the slave ship Creole. And I'm so delighted that you can join us today.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I read the article in The Atlantic that you published recently, and it concerns this lopsided taxing arrangement, which was alluded to in a report, as a matter of fact, as to why it is that we have this inequity, this yawning gap between rich and poor in Ferguson, Missouri. And perhaps you can start off by telling us what you found and what your analysis led you to.
Well, I think that my analysis began with a sort of a shocked insight, which is as I began to look into things in Ferguson, I was struck by the fact that less than a half a mile from where Michael Brown was shot, there's the headquarters of a Fortune 500 company, Emerson Electric. And that company is within the city limits of Ferguson, and that company makes about $24 billion a year. In fact, three or four days before Michael Brown was shot, they had announced third quarter profits for or third quarter income for 2014 of $6 billion. And so without knowing at that point a huge amount about the political economy of Ferguson or the history of St. Louis, I was struck by the fact that in the same city where the police department was farming poor black people and black motorists for revenue, there was this huge corporation. And, you know, how could that be happening was really the question that I began with. And that led me back into some kind of historical investigation of the history of St. Louis and of the United States more generally.
Well, by the time you came to this realization, the Justice Department had pretty much said that the predominantly black population of Ferguson, Missouri, essentially was a targeted population, and that it was on the backs of these people that the tax revenues were basically generated. And the city of Ferguson extracted this revenue by way of excessive ticketing, arrests, fines, and even warrants that were issued to people who couldn't afford to pay these fines. Did you find any concurrence at all with the Justice Department ruling on that?
Let me add to that in a couple of ways. The first thing is simply to say that the Justice Department report is, I think, to some degree unprecedented in the history of the United States, in that it takes what was common sense in the African-American community and raises it to a principle of national governance. Now, that said, everything that is in that report was already common sense within the African-American community in Ferguson, in St. Louis County generally, and I think probably across the United States. It is also true that there had, prior to the killing of Michael Brown and long prior to the Justice Department report, there was a report done by a group called the Arch City Defenders on policing in St. Louis County and North County, on for-profit policing. And so I say that as a way to emphasize the kinds of existing community knowledge and activist knowledge that report reflects. Now, I think that report does something, as I said, unprecedented, which is it takes that kind of knowledge and raises it to a principle of governance espoused by the federal government, but that report also has a limitation. And I would characterize that limitation as a limitation, as the line between an investigation of the systemic racism within the Ferguson Police Department, horrifying in and of itself. What the report does not address is the structural racism surrounding the Ferguson Police Department, surround the historical pattern that frames what happened in Ferguson. So what the report doesn't ask is it notes that the Ferguson Police Department was raising about $2.6 million a year to fill holes, to fill gaps in the Ferguson city budget. That's about 20% of the budget of the city of Ferguson for any given year. It doesn't ask why the city of Ferguson needed to raise that much money. It doesn't ask any questions about the tax base in Ferguson, or the tax assessments in Ferguson, or the pattern of taxation, nor in St. Louis County, nor in the state of Missouri more generally. And so that's where the piece that I wrote in the Atlantic fits in, is it tries to take that assessment of the systemic racism within the police department and embed it in a more historical and structural account of race and capitalism in the United States, but particularly in St. Louis.
So could you explain now how this structure was designed, how it worked, and how it remained practically intact? And even now, as a matter of fact, even with the so-called reforms and administrative changes that are being talked about, it still boils down to you have in the city of Ferguson a Fortune 500 company, and it's not the only one, but it's the largest one. But still we have this lopsided tax arrangement in which this company is not looked to contribute its fair share of taxes, but it is the people, the poor people of Ferguson, who for all these years have been bearing the an inordinate tax burden to maintain an oppressive city. Could you explain? This is at the heart of the article that you wrote.
Right. So the way that I would start to explain that is to think through the long history by which African Americans in the United States have been excluded from property holding. And so you could take that, take that back to the history of slavery and then the history of sharecropping. I mean, 50% of the African American population in the United States in 1941 is still rural, is still living on farms, which means to me that 50% of that population is by and large are sharecroppers. So these are people who, within my father's lifetime, these are families that had been able to accumulate over their history in the United States of America no wealth. No houses, no savings, nothing to bequeath to future generations. And that's not simply a pattern that has to do with slavery and sharecropping. It has to do with local law, state law, and federal law. There's, in many places there is legal residential segregation up until 1917. After 1917, there is de facto residential segregation, even though it is illegal now after 1917 by a Supreme Court decision to say no black people can move into this neighborhood. What there are restricted covenants. And a restricted covenant is a deed, which means that if you're going to buy a house in this neighborhood, part of the contract that exists at the time of buying a house, a white person buying a house from a white person, is an agreement not to sell that house to any other, to a person, a non-white person. So restricted covenants are legal in the United States until 1941, and a case that is a Supreme Court case, Shelley versus Kramer, that actually originates in St. Louis. But during that period of time, and even after, the federal government provides subsidies, what are in effect racially specific subsidies to white homeownership. Federal housing association loans, federal guaranteed loans that are available only to those living in restricted covenant neighborhoods. So between 1943 and 1960, St. Louis County, which is during that time majority white, received five times as many federally guaranteed home loans as did the racially mixed city of St. Louis. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 explicitly excluded the question of housing from consideration. And then this is the period in which the long period, say between 1934 and say 1970, when African American neighborhoods are torn down to build interstate highways, which are an effective subsidy to suburban neighborhoods, right? Because what they allow is for white people to move out to the suburbs and then come into the center city to work if that's where their jobs still are. So where you have federal programs, the FHA, the GI Bill, the certain benefits of the Social Security Act, which are available only to effectively to whites. And so there is a long period in which white home ownership is subsidized. Now, that might legally begin to change around 1968, say, when there's the Fair Housing Act. So let's imagine that up until 1968, there are substantial barriers to black people getting a hold of real estate in the United States of America. Well, what happens in 1970 is partly because of easy money policies at the Fed, the housing market shoots up. there's a massive increase in the capital benefit, the wealth benefit of owning a house. Well, African Americans haven't had a chance to buy houses by 1968. All of a sudden, white families are getting rich off of this half century of subsidies to whiteness, and African Americans are excluded from that that benefit. And that's a pattern which has carried down to the present day, and in fact was intensified by the 2008 economic crash, which began in the subprime mortgage market. It began in the mortgage market that had been developed to try to make money off of African Americans and other minorities and poor people who were trying to move into home ownership. That disaster began in that segment of the housing market, which meant that the effects of that disaster were disproportionately visited upon African Americans. And there are some estimates that 50% of the real estate wealth that African Americans had managed to accrue by 2008 was destroyed by that economic catastrophe. So that's a very long answer to try to frame the privileges of real property, of owning property in relationship to race, and particularly the overdevelopment, the privileging of whiteness.
So in the city of Ferguson now, since there isn't a substantial home ownership base and in terms of black home ownership, and you still have these tax-levied services that the city has to finance, they have to get the money some other way.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
So there is this wonderful scheme that is cooked up. They're here. They dominate in the city as far as the population is concerned. They're not homeowners, but we still have to get money. Now, how do you square the decision between the administration, whatever local government existed at whatever time, that it made sense to target the poor people, the black people who have no homes and can't pay the property taxes commensurate with the city expenses, and at the same time ignore a Fortune 500 company that is making $26 billion a year?
Yeah, well, that's the riddle, and I mean, and that's the point, and that's where I would say that the structural racism of the history of St. Louis is then reactivated in a set of decisions that are made at the level of the Ferguson city manager and city council. So Ferguson is a city, like many of the municipalities in St. Louis County, that has very, very low taxes on real estate. And indeed, that is true throughout the state of Missouri, because there is a constitutional limitation on how municipalities can raise money. So that dates from 1980. So municipalities in the state of Missouri, and this is true across the nation in different ways, are extraordinarily constrained in how they can raise money. One of the ways that municipalities can raise money that is officially not a tax is by raising fines and fees, right? Charging people more to go to the park or giving them more traffic tickets. And that's what Ferguson did, and that's what different municipalities throughout North County St. Louis have done, is that they have raised money through fines and fees in order to fund the city government. Now, that would be bad, but not disgracefully bad, if they were actually trying to provide services for the residents of the city. But one of the things you find out if you look at the Ferguson city budget is really what they're doing is that they are providing benefits for the majority white employees of the Ferguson city government. So they're building a new police station. They're building a new fire station. They're buying all the policemen new Chevrolet Tahoes, like the one that Darren Wilson was driving. They bought them all new handguns, like the one with which Darren Wilson shot Michael Brown in 2013. So the bulk of the money that the Ferguson city government raised through these regressive taxes, through taxes, sales tax, fines, fees, all of these things fall more heavily on the poor than the rich. They are all regressive taxes. The bulk of that money was being used to fund the overdevelopment of the Ferguson city government itself. Meanwhile, real property, real estate property, the property owned by wealthy people, was going under or untaxed. So that's how I think the long history of St. Louis and the sort of structural history of the relationship between racism and exclusion from wealth and real property holding then come to manifest in Ferguson in this and Ferguson is by far the only city, little municipality in St. Louis that's like this, or really in the United States, in this pattern of trying to farm the population, African American and poor population for fines and then for warrants. Now, another way to relate what happened in Ferguson to the long history of race and real estate is to simply recognize that a lot of the warrants in Ferguson, arrest warrants, were issued for failure to appear at a given court date. Well, the way that somebody who's got a traffic ticket is notified about getting a court date is through the mail. But mailing court dates to a housing insecure population is a predictable way to produce arrest warrants, because somebody has one address at one time and another address at a different time. So if the mail goes to the old address, they don't get the notification of the court date, and a warrant gets issued for their arrest. And so there were some extraordinary number of outstanding arrest warrants at the time of the shooting of Michael Brown. I mean, it's maybe 12,000 outstanding arrest warrants at that moment.
But in the middle of all of this economic crisis, there is, just the same as the say goes, there is great opportunity. And one of the best opportunities that presents itself is the opportunity to systematically empty a city of its undesirable population, repopulate it with desirable people. And we've seen that in cities like Detroit and Flint and other places in Michigan and around the country, most of these communities being majority non-white communities that are targeted this way. Recently, in fact, just last month, we got an indication that plan was already in motion when Moody's Investors Service reduced Ferguson's credit rating down 7 notches to junk status. Is that not an indicator that there is a sense within a very closed community that Ferguson is prime for the taking?
I think that's probably true. I mean, I would start in a slightly different place, which is with the Justice Department report. So the Justice Department report says the Ferguson Police Department can no longer raise revenue in this obscene manner. But because the Justice Department report does not address the larger structural situation, it doesn't even contemplate the notion that not being able to raise revenue in this obscene manner will destroy the city of Ferguson, right? So there's no effort there to think about, well, what would be a larger way to imagine a flourishing city of Ferguson, right? Now, I think that there were certainly people in and around Ferguson who felt that on the night in November of last year when the grand jury announced its decision at 8 p.m., right, i.e. after dark, and when there was a very vigorous police presence on South Florissant Avenue in front of the police department and in the part of Ferguson where there's been a significant amount of municipal investment and where, not coincidentally, the white population is centered. And there was no police presence whatsoever, zero, on West Florissant Avenue, which had been the site of the uprising in August. That was a more or less conscious way to allow West Florissant Avenue to be destroyed, to just rip out the heart of that community, struggling community that it was, and, you know, to clear the ground for reinvestment. I am not maybe as inclined to conspiratorial thinking as my friends in Ferguson, perhaps because I haven't lived in Ferguson, as to immediately think that that's true. But for the life of me, I can't come up with another explanation. I've spent whatever it is, almost a year now, trying to come up with another explanation for why there would be no police on West Florissant Avenue that night, and why the grand jury decision would be announced, although it had been, everybody had known since noon it was going to be announced. So the report, you know, whatever McCulloch came out and said, must have existed at noon. Why they waited until after dark to do that? I've been thinking for a year about that, and the only explanation that has made any sense to me at all is this one coming from my friends in Ferguson, that it was an effort to allow the community to be destroyed. So I think that there is probably a lot of speculation going on in, I think this has probably been going on in Ferguson and in St. Louis County since 2008. There's a lot of speculation going on in distressed property and forfeited property. There's a lot of real estate holding companies that are involved in buying things up. And yes, I think it is completely plausible that you'll see a pattern of gentrifying investment in Ferguson emerging out of this crisis.
Late last month, the city of Ferguson turned to Emerson, the Fortune 500 company that's within the city limits, asking for it to basically come up with a bit more money. Number one, was this when a city has a meeting with a company and says, could you please put some more money in the pot? It suggests that the company wasn't paying its fair share all along. Do you happen to know what the taxes on Emerson were, what Emerson was paying in terms of taxes to the city of Ferguson?
Yeah, it's all public information, and it's a little bit difficult to figure out, because while I was doing this research, I actually made several calls to the finance department in the city of Ferguson and was not able to get anybody to return those calls. But if you look at the county tax assessment for Emerson, it is there's 152 acres of property that Emerson Electric owns in the city of Ferguson. There's seven buildings on that property. The most recent building there is a building that the stated building cost of which was $50 million. It's a building that is advertised as having a value of $50 million. The assessed value of that entire property, 152 acres with seven buildings on it, including this data center, is $15 million. Now, because of the privileges of property that we were discussing earlier, real property in St. Louis County is subject to before taxes are actually assessed, it's multiplied downwards by 0.32. So that means that 152 acres with seven buildings, including a $50 million building, is actually assessed for tax purposes for St. Louis County, for the whole county, at about $4 million. And so then if you work out what Ferguson would be entitled to of that, based on that assessment, it's about $55,000. Now that's the property taxes. There would be some tax that they would get on the basis of franchise taxes, which are taxes on electricity usage and things like that. But it's really scandalously, in my view, low. $55,000, I suggest, in the Atlantic piece is just about enough money to pay the now disgraced municipal court judge to sign all these tickets and warrants to then raise money from the impoverished inhabitants and motorists.
I want to thank you so much, Professor Johnson, for bringing this to our attention today and for sharing this information. And it won't be your first dive. We have to come back to this a bit more because I always believe in discussing these things in the sense that these developments are really templates for what is to come, in the same way that we concentrated so hard on understanding what was going on in Detroit, because it was, as I contended then and still do contend, it's a template for what's coming in a neighborhood near you. So this was a very extraordinary article in The Atlantic. I urge people to get a copy of it. Go online, atlantic.com, and look at this article by Dr. Walter Johnson. Thank you so much, and you'll be with us again soon, I hope.
Great. Thank you for the work you're doing. I appreciate it.
Thank you. We'll take this break and come back and talk about that wonderful Q&A posing as a debate coming up tonight.
There is no hope left in your kingdom.
You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM, and of course, this is your very favorite program. Five Democratic candidates, presidential candidates, will participate in a nationally televised Q&A session. That's what I call it. It's the host, CNN, insists it's a debate, but it's happening tonight in Las Vegas. The venue is the opulent five-star Wynn Las Vegas Resort and Casino. Oddly enough, an ironic twist for a political party that swears it's about the working class. Yet, it is perfectly in line with where politics is right now. Dave Leventhal, who leads the Center for Public Integrity's reporting team on federal politics, is with us now to discuss the presidential race, and which, by all indicators, will be the most expensive in U.S. history. Thanks, Dave, for being with us today.
Hey, a pleasure to be with you.
Well, you wrote a piece for the Center on this being the most expensive race, presidential race in U.S. history. Please explain.
Well, it seems like we say this every presidential race, although there's something different in 2016 than we've certainly seen in previous presidential races. And that's really the full flourishing of what we like to refer to as outside political groups coming into play during the presidential race. And what I mean by that is groups known as super PACs, and also to nonprofit organizations that have the ability to individually raise and spend unlimited amounts of money to advocate for and against presidential candidates. The same can be done also at the congressional level, or even the state or local level, too. And this is all really in the aftermath of the Supreme Court's Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission decision back in 2010 that made it much easier for organizations to do exactly that, raise and spend unlimited amounts of money. And is just a bottom line, created a much different type of political environment during campaign seasons than we saw prior to the Citizens United decision, for better or for worse.
What kind of money are we talking about? I had previously talked about the fact that just for advertising alone, the campaigns altogether are expected to spend upwards of $5 billion this year. This is ridiculous.
It's also entirely possible, too. And it should be noted that it's a very expensive proposition by any measure to run for president of the United States. It's not as if you're just running in a single district or a single state. You're running in 50 states. And the way that the election system is set up, you have a primary and a caucus in effectively every state. And during a very, very competitive season, such as 2016, when both on the Republican and the Democratic side, you've got a lot of competition, particularly on the Republican side, and you have numerous viable candidates. We don't know who the nominee ultimately is going to be. On the Democratic side, it seems like Hillary Clinton remains the front runner, but at the same time, too, Bernie Sanders has made a very impressive charge at her election supremacy. So, as a result, you add all this up together and you have numerous candidates who in and of themselves are raising lots of money. And then all of these outside groups that exist part and parcel to support their candidacies that are raising, in some cases already, tens and tens of millions of dollars. The most notable case being the super PAC that exists to support Jeb Bush, which has already cracked the $100 million mark, and that was just as of mid-year, an incredible amount of money at such an early stage. So if that's any indicator of what's to come, I don't know what would be a better measure than that.
But it's not just the candidates who are spending money. I mean, this race, to my mind, this presidential campaign also has ensnared the media. They're spending tons of money, hoping to make even more money with the broadcast of these things. And it's like a kind of reality show slash game slash it's a huge marketing effort. CNN hosting the so-called debates, I keep calling them the Q&A sessions, the dog and pony shows, because nobody's really debating each other. They're answering questions that are posed to them. But the media seems to have a vested interest here also in the marketing. So it's a huge industry that is all about money, the lobbyists, the polling companies, the media organizations with their huge sets and, you know, the all the bells and whistles and the choreography of all of this. When it used to be kind of simple, you know, the League of Women Voters would have debate night and people would just come there and, you know, actually debate. But it has become a huge Hollywood type production. And all of this predicated on the idea that there's huge amounts of money to be made out of it. So there's this a kind of incestuous relationship between the media and the campaigns and the candidates. That's how it feels to me. I don't know how it feels to you.
Well, to take your point about the money to be made off a presidential race, you're absolutely correct in the notion that there is an incredible amount of money to be made off of political elections, and not just by the candidates' committees in and of themselves, but by television media, by digital media, by political consultants, by all of the superstructure, if you will, that gets created during a campaign season that is, again, as competitive as this one, but also, too, as long as this one. And this is an incredibly lengthy campaign. Mm-hmm. It's amazing to think that a year from now, we still won't have the election decided. It'll still be a few weeks before Election Day. But we wrote a story late last week that talked about the television advertising already at this juncture surrounding the presidential campaign. Hillary Clinton's campaign alone has sponsored more than 5,500 television ads, and we're still a couple of months away before the first primaries and caucuses. That's a lot of advertising that will certainly benefit a lot of television stations who host it, but they're not the only ones. Radio stations and online properties and even old line media such as newspapers all benefit from the advertising that will go forth from the campaigns, and also these outside groups that and oftentimes are going to do the bulk of a candidate's advertising, in the sense that a super PAC will go up with multi-million dollar ad buys that will be incredibly lucrative to the people who are hosting, or the organizations, media properties that are hosting those advertisements. So it's definitely, for a lot of people, it's distasteful. But at the same time, too, you have candidates who really haven't even begun to play that game. One example, both from the right and the left. On the right, Donald Trump, love him or leave him, he hasn't had a single television advertisement that he's put up, because he says, look, I'm getting all the press that I need to. I'm the best candidate in the race. Everyone's paying attention to me. I don't need to advertise on TV. And then on the Democratic side, you have Bernie Sanders, who also has eschewed television, at least to this date, not put up any ads, has been very much in grassroots mode and retail politicking mode, and has been able to attract, in some cases, 5, 10, 20,000 people to in-person rallies that he's conducted. So in a way, we do have sort of a mixing of philosophies here and a mixing of approaches. And without any question, again, on the Republican side and the Democratic side, numerous options. And we'll see tonight for the first time all of the, well, at least most of the Democratic candidates who we think are Democratic candidates sharing the same stage together. Larry Lessig, a Harvard professor who got into the race just last month, has not been invited to the debate. And then obviously Joe Biden has not decided yet whether he is going to run. And even though he had qualified for the debate, is likely not going to be on stage tonight.
Well, this is the thing. In the middle of all of this, we still have the questionable role of the media here, not only of changing the landscape, the political landscape, but it's actually part of this whole thing. It's a shutout, because when you have the media deciding who is to be heard by virtue of, you know, where they place in national polls, who is to be invited to talk. The Democrats are now even fighting among themselves, because they have been taken a position that the candidates should not appear in other debates or Q&A sessions outside of the ones that already have been sanctioned and agreed to. This is punitive. We have essentially a shutout. If you're not Republican, if you're not Democrat, and certainly if you have no money, you don't merit a hearing at all. So you don't get to present yourself to the American public. The second thing is, you mentioned Donald Trump. Well, Donald Trump, why should Donald Trump pay when the media was so eager to create him and adopt him and promote him? He was getting free press. But there was a slight thing that I had pointed out to you. I don't know if you agree with it, but I had said that Donald Trump was being used by the media to leverage, to open the sluices, and it seems to have worked, because without a Donald Trump being the kind of, you know, a fire ant, the other candidates would not have spent this much money. Hillary Clinton would not have taken out 5,500 ads so far. So he's a good foil for the media. And so the incestuous relationship of the media saying, okay, we will give you free advertising, we'll give you free coverage, you don't have to pay for it, because the money that we save you, we will get from the other candidates who will be provoked into advertising because of the role that Trump is playing, which is that of, you know, the agitator in chief.
So a couple of points. I think one thing that the people in terms of media coverage should take heart in, at least in 2016, is that there's such a diversity of media, quote unquote, that are covering this race. And for certain, the television media that are hosting the debates have a certain stature that perhaps a news website would not have or a radio station might not have. That's definitely an obvious point going forward that they're going to have the ability to play a starring role in a way that others perhaps will not. I would point out, though, that the first two Republican debates had an incredibly high viewership. So we could definitely talk about and discuss the particulars of how the debate was run and whether certain candidates got more favor than others or sort of the circus atmosphere of it all, too. But from another standpoint, it attracted a massive, massive crowd in an era when it's difficult for anything short of, say, the Super Bowl or the World Series to attract a huge number of people to all together watch the same thing. So in a way, it did have a positive effect in getting a whole lot of people who might not otherwise pay attention to politics to pay attention to politics. We may see that again tonight as well. And also, too, there's, again, to go back to the notion of a diversity of media, the media is not this monolithic thing. There's so many different types of news outlets today, whether it's online or whether it's in print. We have magazines and TV stations, radio stations. Turn on your cable TV and you've got 500 different channels. So if you are somebody who is a discerning voter, somebody who is looking for a diversity of news, you have perhaps today more options than you've ever had in our lifetimes. And that should be an exciting thing for people who care about politics. And it should be a challenging thing for people, too, to seek out new veins of information, to seek out new news sources, and to see the kind of creative work that I love seeing all the time about covering presidential politics and covering politics in general. And that's even something that, as we speak right now, is very much evolving and something that between now and the time that we stage the election in November of 2016 could change even more, depending on what websites or what news outlets have poured resources into covering the presidential race in different or novel ways. I'm pretty excited about the prospects.
Well, I'm glad one of us is. But as we close, I want to ask you, though, from the point of view of the Center for Public Integrity, what is all this money, this flooding of the political realm with all of this money? What does it in any way imperil our notions of the democratic process?
Well, first of all, the Center for Public Integrity, we're a nonprofit investigative news organization, and we exist in large part to really dive deeply in terms of who is trying to pull on the levers of power. So to your question, what we're trying to find out constantly in our reporting is, number one, who potentially stands to benefit from their investments that they make in politics? Who might get a return on their investment? Who are the people, the organizations, the players who are marshaling resources in order to support a certain candidate or a certain policy position over another? And then answer the question of, well, why are they doing that? So much of our reporting is directed in this way, and we feel, quite frankly, that it's essential and incumbent on us to, regardless of whether you're liberal or conservative or Democrat or Republican, to bore down as deep as we possibly can go to find out who truly is trying to either game the system for their benefit or trying to tip the scales toward their favor when it comes to their interactions with politics. And we do that without favor to party or philosophy. And it's very liberating for us to be able to do that in this in a very straightforward way so that the public, voters, people who care about politics, people who are affected by politics, have an opportunity to see an unvarnished and unbiased report of the news as we can determine it about candidates who stand to affect their lives and affect their communities in very, very profound ways were they to rise to a position of power even greater than the ones that they are today.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us today and for bringing to our attention why all this money is circulating in a process that one would have imagined would have been free of all of this. But it's getting more and more complicated and more moneyed. But you do appreciate the irony that this so-called debate is being held at a five-star hotel for a party that says we are about the working class.
It's definitely not at the local firehouse, I can tell you that. Yep.
Thanks, Dave Leventhal, for being with us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, that brings us to the end of the program, practically. Just a couple of notes. You should check in to see, just because it's the first, to see this Dog and Pony show. See a little bit of it, because we're going to be talking a bit about it. But we will be talking about it from an entirely different perspective, as usual. We'll be taking note of what questions are asked, what questions are answered, the environment in which this Q&A, I insist it's a Q&A, it's not a debate, is being held. What does this say about politics at this time and in our experience in the United States? The role of money in shaping public opinion, the role of the media as a voluntary extension of this warped political process, in which the major thrust for everyone is look for more and more money out of it. That's really what we're talking about here. It's being disguised as a number of things: the need to inform the public, and public service, and all of that kind of stuff. But bottom line, we're talking about a huge industry that has now fully blossomed and is operating at full throttle, and the media organizations are at front and center of it. And, of course, they wouldn't take any responsibility for this, but they nonetheless are responsible for the corruption of this process of democracy. So thank you so much for joining me today. I hope the program was helpful, and we will come back to each other tomorrow for more good programming right here at PRN.FM. Keep it right here. Coming up next is The Infectious Myth with David Crow, and you can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. Let me know how this program is resonating with you. Until then, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Bye-bye. Thank you.